Welcome to the Open House Podcast. Conversations exploring life, faith and hope with Stephen O'Doherty.
Charity groups like Brotherhood of St. Lawrence, Anglicare, St. Vincent de Paul, ACOS, they're all banding together to seek an increase in social security payments. The groups they're most concerned about are people on Newstart, that's the Job Seeker Allowance. Now here's a question, could you live on $270 a week? You might say, oh yeah, someone gave me $270. No, $270 a week for housing, rent or mortgage, for electricity, for water, for food, for transport, for seeking a job. That's the allowance for a single person, $39 a day. And the charities say that's just not enough to get by on, especially with rents at very high levels. So their call for an improvement is a call that they hope will be fulfilled this coming week on Tuesday. And it's not just those groups as well. The Business Council and its head, Jennifer Westacott, has agreed it's impossible to live on the Newstart allowance. She said a lot of these people are shockingly disadvantaged. We spoke with Susan King, the head of advocacy and research for Anglicare.
I know some people have been saying that they could easily live on $270 a week, but if you've actually got to pay rent, even in a shared house or a shared room, that still gives you virtually nothing to live on in terms of food. And the study that we've just done on private rental in Sydney indicates that there's basically nothing affordable for people who are single on Newstart. So we know that it's just generating incredible financial hardship, and it's really hard for people to get out the door. It's hard for people to catch a bus to go and to even go to job interviews.
As you talk to agencies around the country, your colleagues, it's a very similar picture though, isn't it?
Yes. Honestly, it's national. When we did the study across the whole of Australia, and less than 6% of properties were affordable. But for single people on Newstart, for single people on disability support pensions, for young people on youth allowance, there was nothing affordable across the country. This is a very serious issue. And one of the new trends that we've discovered in the work that we've been doing over the last few weeks is that instead of people trying to rent a room in a shared house, it's now rent a bed in a shared room.
Oh.
That's how it's developed over the last 12 or 18 months. People are getting desperate. So if you go onto any of those, on any of the platforms that are actually the listings for property, for rental, you'll find there's a significant number saying you can rent a mattress on a floor, basically, and you'll be paying $150 to $200 a week for that. And if you're on Newstart or youth allowance and you're getting $270 a week, it doesn't give you much left, does it? And apart from anything else, who's going to say that that sort of accommodation is appropriate?
So I suppose there are people listening who would say to themselves, well, I had no idea.
Well, I think that's true. We've been actually reporting on rental affordability now for about the last 7 years. We do this every year at this time. But this is the first time this whole issue of rent a bed in a room has actually come up as a significant issue. And it seems to be a lot more prevalent than it was 12 or 18 months ago. It wasn't that obvious to us 12 months ago as researchers. So this seems to be a trend with how people are coping, how people are trying to get off the streets, not be homeless, at least have a roof over their head. But the reality is that if you're spending $180 to $200 a week on rent, that leaves you $70 a week for food, for transport, and for clothes and for a whole range of things, including access to the internet, phones. People have got to have mobile phones in order to be able to stay in contact, to be able to meet their Centrelink requirements. So it's very, very difficult for people. And the particular issue that we can see is particularly for people who are on their own, single people. The poverty issue for people who are single, particularly people on Newstart or on disability support benefits, is very, very high.
Mm-hmm. You could say, why did it get that way? Well, it got that way through a series of small increases over time, whereas cost of living went up a lot more over time. But do you think there's a sense that we're a bit mean-spirited as a country?
Look, I don't know. I suppose my concern is the way these things are indexed and the way these things are set. I think it would be really important to have some sort of external body, an external statutory body that would actually set this rather than have it being set through Parliament and through budget. So that's being done by an independent body and they're looking at the actual standard of living for people. I think that would be a fairer system, and I think that's being called for by a number of different bodies as well.
Mm. There are so many things that compete for a federal budget. You ask, where would the priority be? Would it be for people on unemployment benefit, people with disabilities? That's got to be right up there. That'll be probably my number one, personally. Overseas aid would be right up there for me. I wonder whether people have ever really thought through that question. What would your list of priorities be as an agency?
Well, I think Anglicare's priorities would be looking after those people who are experiencing extreme financial hardship.
One way or the other.
Yeah, and those people who are actually really struggling to put a roof over their head. We have a significant concern for two particular people groups coming through our doors. Mm. One is older single women over the age of 50, who we find are becoming increasingly at risk of homelessness. They may have been in a situation where the relationship they've been in over many years has broken down, or they've experienced ill health, or they've suddenly become unemployed. They can't get back into that, finding it really hard getting a job. They don't have anywhere to stay. They're trying to survive on Newstart on $270 a week. Those women increasingly who've never been homeless before, who've always been in work or whatever, are now highly vulnerable and highly at risk. And the other group we're concerned about is those families who are coming through with children. And increasingly, the number of people who are coming through who are homeless or at risk of homelessness have children. And that would be our agency's concern, would be those children and those children experiencing homelessness and intergenerational poverty. For us, that would be probably the most important focus.
In a report you're going to release in a week or so, you've looked at social isolation and its relationship with poverty. So I guess those groups that you're speaking about there, it's not just that life is difficult, but once it's difficult, it becomes difficult in almost every way. And you're isolated and then there's no one to speak for you. This is a voice that's not heard. No one's listening.
People become sort of invisible, I think, which is one of the issues that we've, one of the problems that we see. People, their voices don't get heard and they do become invisible. Interestingly, we did a study on food poverty several years ago, and we did a lot of interviews with parents. And the thing that became obvious to us was that when parents were actually talking about not having food on the table, so often the children would go hungry, would go to school without lunches, or they would go to school and maybe have a whole day where they didn't have anything to eat, and this would happen fairly regularly. Mm. So in the end, the parents would keep those kids home from school because the kids were embarrassed about not having food, not having lunch, or they would get teased, and they would keep them home, and then they wouldn't invite school friends over after school because they couldn't give them afternoon tea, they couldn't entertain the kids, it was embarrassing. And increasingly, there was a sort of form of self-exclusion from those kids being linked into other friends and also from school. And so school, which is the trajectory for these kids to get out of poverty, actually there were barriers to going to school because of the poverty itself. So they're the sorts of things that we'd have significant concerns about.
Well, we like to look for hope in the community, and Anglicare is certainly one of the great agencies that's providing hope. You're doing that because other people have made resources available for you to use, and as the phrase goes, in God's economy, there's lots of resources to go around. It's just a question of how we allocate them. But I wonder, can you talk to me about some of the stories of hope that you've seen, and maybe even some of those stories, and I'm thinking about your family there that you've spoken about, the child isolated at school. I'm thinking, you wouldn't go to a birthday party because you couldn't give a gift. Mm. Maybe one of the things that you could do at school is to say, look, we're going to have a birthday party, but don't bring gifts, have some other way of celebrating, but it doesn't put pressure on those people that can't contribute, can't feel included.
Yeah, look, I think working through, one of the great privileges for me has been working in Anglicare and seeing the amazing work they do out there in the community. And things like our mobile community pantry, where we actually have a mobile food pantry that we take around to various churches across Sydney, and we open that up and people can come and buy, bags of food, fresh food and a whole range of food for, like $10 basically, so they can fill up a big bag of food and take home to their families. Mm. And we're finding that that's actually a really good connection point as well for families to meet up with other families in the same situation, but also to get them connected to churches and the supports available in churches. There are a whole range of programs. We've done a whole lot of work with our mental health programs, linking people into all sorts of communities and groups, et cetera, that actually elevate well-being, improve people's ability to cope and resilience. And I think that's the value of the work that we're doing on the ground, is that we actually do create change. We do make a difference. We work with those communities to strengthen them and to make a difference. And I think there's a lot of hope in the work that we do. You know, the situation is difficult, but we know that within that situation, God moves. God provides, particularly provides for Anglicare to be able to assist these people out in the community. And it's great if we can provide those pathways, particularly through our local churches.
Susan King is our guest on Open House. She's the head of advocacy and research at Anglicare. The debate about welfare is so often staged in terms of a hand up or a hand out. And people say, oh, we'll give you a hand up so that you don't have to rely on hand out. But it's such naive ideology. It really fails to understand the dramatic whole of life intergenerational impact of living in poverty, not having a job, not having self-esteem, not having access, all the things that you were talking about. And so charity steps in. And it kind of says to government, well, we'll pick up the slack. And government says, well, that's great because we rely on our charities. But there's something for all of us to do, because I just wonder if even when we keep giving to charity, which we must all do, nevertheless, that doesn't absolve me of my responsibility to keep an eye out for my neighbour. And what I love about the programs you've just been speaking about is that you've got a church community now doing what the early church did. That it's gathering the community around it. Maybe people are bringing the vegetables they've grown at home. Maybe there's a way of swapping food resources and looking out for each other. There's potluck lunches, all that sort of stuff. This is how the early church lived, isn't it?
Yes, I think so. And I think one of the things that we're trying to... one of the reasons why we have such an amazing collaboration and partnership with our parishes is because really they're the footholds in the community. One of the issues that we're going to have in the next 6 weeks or so, when it all comes to fruition, is there's going to be a large number of asylum seekers who are going to be in desperate need as there's been some changes made to their payments. Some of those people are going to be classified as work ready, and within 4 weeks all their payments are going to be stopped.
Yep.
And those people are actually, we know from past experience that those people will start flooding our churches because they're the obvious places of safety, security, and support that they can go to. Yeah. So we want to be able to resource our churches, and we want to be able to encourage our churches and our parishes to be able to support those people in the community. So we're trying to put resources together now because we're anticipating this is going to be a particular need.
Mm.
But churches are an amazing source of what you'd call social capital or social cohesion, where churches themselves can be thriving communities, and they can be supportive of each other, but they can also be supportive and outreach to others in their community. They can become bridges out into the community. So I think churches are a really essential element in this whole hope-filled factor in terms of how we do our work.
Indeed. Susan King, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks, Stephen.
Susan King, and she's from Anglicare, one of a number of agencies around the country asking the government, urging the government, to do something about the New Start allowance. Let's go a little bit deeper on that question. In fact, can we be smarter, more innovative in the way that we deliver solutions that bring, well, I guess, human flourishing, that actually help to grow our communities in ways that create jobs and don't necessarily allow people to continue to depend on welfare? We spoke with Nicholas Gruen on this program a little while ago. He's the CEO of Lateral Economics, and they do take a lateral look at how things go. He's an economist whose views we really enjoy. I spoke with Nicholas Gruen about the budget, and he also agreed that one of the first priorities would have to be to increase New Start.
I think I'm right in saying it was the Hawke-Keating Labor government that decided to penny pinch on the dole a long time ago by indexing the dole to CPI rather than to wages. In other words, by indexing the dole to the rise in consumer prices, not the rise in wages, whereas everything else, like the old age pension, was indexed to wages. And over a couple of decades, in fact, a bit more than a couple of decades, I think, this has now produced a huge gap between most welfare payments and the dole. And next time you step over a homeless person, ask yourself whether that's a good idea, because the amount of money you get on the dole is very, very difficult to live. And it's causing a huge amount of suffering. And Even business leaders have said it's not enough money. But of course, so they've lent their passive support, if you like, to raising it. But of course, when push comes to shove, they're in there arguing for company tax cuts ahead of raising the dole. So that's something that is one of the most important things to do.
Indeed. Nicholas Gruen is with us, economist with Lateral Economics. And an economist we like because we like thinking about big themes in budgets and also about human flourishing in the middle of all of that. One of the headline debates, arguments, I suppose, is going to be, of course, the deficit and the surplus. And we're being primed to expect a return to surplus within the forward estimates. In other words, before or during the next election, a cycle, which could be one commentator suggested even later this year. But then you've got to say, well, what does surplus mean in that context? Because there are a lot of projects that are done by government that are off the government's balance sheet because they're with statutory authorities and so on. What's your view as an economist on that issue and generally about surplus versus deficit budgeting?
Well, I'm afraid it's a question of depends. So all other things being equal, and partly for political reasons, I'm in favour of running small, sustained surpluses. But if you're in a recession, you shouldn't be running a surplus. And in fact, that's the point of trying to run surpluses in the good years, to try to lean against the wind when there is a downturn. And those surpluses should be operating surpluses, so they shouldn't relate to investment. And unfortunately, we take account of those things, but we do it in a way which is sort of driven by accounting conventions and by political imperatives. So the Turnbull government has made quite a few announcements on infrastructure, and lots of them I expect to be off the budget. So it's easy for them to make. Malcolm Turnbull was in Melbourne recently talking about putting, I think it was $5 billion into a train link to the airport. And of course, everyone thinks a train link to the airport's a good idea. I'm not here to tell you it's a bad idea, but what we should be doing is not litigating these questions as part of a campaign. We should actually try and be investing infrastructure money according to the evidence, according to need, and those needs are quite complex. In fact, I seem to recall the Prime Minister saying something quite similar to that, more so in opposition than in government. Likewise, the other side.
You talk a lot about building social goods, that is, social capital and so on. Yep. Would our infrastructure spending program then be better if its first priority was things like public housing?
I think that's kind of 75% yes answer to that. It's not so much an either-or thing.
No, of course not.
And the other thing is that a lot of these things, I've just been reading some stuff. In fact, it's on my desk. It's called Austerity Britain, and I should read a similar book on post-war reconstruction in Australia. After World War II, governments decided they were going to get into building social goods. And one of the things they did in doing that is that the government crowded out all kinds of community self-help mechanisms. You know, think of friendly societies and things like that, where whole communities would come together and co-insure and would, if you like, they kind of came up with smaller scale private welfare systems. Now, it's not entirely clear that I look upon the establishment of the welfare state as a great thing, not a thing without some costs and some troubles, but a great thing. But it isn't necessarily the case. It's probably not the case that we should just get government to build houses. You know, there's a lot of skill in learning how to do this well. And I don't know whether we do that. I don't think we do that sort of thing well. And the political debate is had at such a crude level of, you know, this or that, as if the government should be doing everything, when we sort of want to try and get these social goods growing within communities. So I don't know whether that's a bit of a that might sound a bit evasive. It's not a yes or no question, but we do seem to be, there are lots of places, there are lots of ways in which we are losing social capital, and
yes.
That's a pretty serious thing. And we are expecting politicians to come up with quick tricks to solve it.
Right.
It's probably asking for trouble.
Yep,
which is not to endorse the just leave it alone. That's not what I'm arguing.
I think governments
have an important role. The governments are the agent of the community, but when they build things and get their bureaucrats to order everyone around and go on a list, and someone says to somebody, right, well, you've come up on the waiting list and this is your house and it's 20 miles from where you live and 40 miles from your work.
Right.
Those are the kinds of dysfunctions that happen, and so we have to try and be more sophisticated about those.
No, that's really exciting. It's about co-investment with the community in creating social goods, I think, is one way that you're saying it. But let the community fully be involved.
That's a good way to put it.
Well, that's Dr. Nicholas Gruen of Lateral Economics and the idea that government can get involved with community but not replace community, and that community can then learn new skills and do things together. I loved his reference to the old friendly societies, these mutual cooperative associations where you're sort of in it together, you know, you're co-investing with your neighbours. And there was a similar reference, I think, to that sort of work by churches in our interview earlier with Anglicare. This is the future. This is back to a future in which we help each other. We don't rely on government alone. But government policies, government economic settings, government initiatives can help to enable some of these schemes that allow us to be more of a community together. That's the way we were meant to be. It's not so great when you hive off your community responsibilities to a government and then trust the government to do the right thing. Now, this is where I think we're all trying to move forward together, and churches ought to be leading the forefront, leading that sort of innovation in the community.
Discover more Open House podcasts at openhousecommunity.com.au.